Texas. In Monday Night Football, tonight New Orleans meets Carolina. NBA, Bucks and Bulls off last night. Tonight the Bucks play in Detroit. The Bulls play in Oklahoma City. In the NHL, the Blackhawks lost to San Jose 7-3. They are off tonight. Now the WGTD Monday forecast from the National Weather Service. Sunny and seasonal today. We should see an afternoon high of 36. Right now, 34 degrees in Racine, 32 this morning in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:10, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackanddrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have two conversations for you on today's program, a brand new conversation about conversation in part two, a look at the sometimes unappreciated intelligence that is necessary for a lot of work that is done by so-called blue-collar workers in our society. That's a book called The Mind at Work. That's coming up in part two of today's program. But here's part one. And in this portion of WGTD's morning show, we're going to have a conversation about conversation and about the whole business of questions and answers and about the ways in which we can more thoughtfully and perhaps more wisely or smartly or effectively answer those questions that are posed to us in a whole plethora of different situations. The book at hand is called Control the Conversation, How to Charm, Deflect, and Defend Your Position Through Any Line of Questioning. And although this book is not specifically limited to this, as you can probably gather from the title, this book and the information it offers might be especially helpful for those that maybe find themselves on occasion and maybe on a regular basis in situations in which they are being confronted with questions, sometimes challenging questions. And this book is full of practical advice on how best to respond. The co-author of the book, Marianne Carinch, is actually a body language expert and the author and co-author of more than two dozen different books, including How to Spot a Liar and Find Out Anything from Anyone, Anytime. And she is the founder of the Rudy Agency, which is based in Estes Park, Colorado. And this book is published by Career Press, again titled Control the Conversation, How to Charm, Deflect, and Defend Your Position Through Any Line of Questioning. Marianne Carinch, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you, Greg. It's great to be with you.
Can you first explain, in a sense, the connection between what we first read in your biography, that you are a body language expert, and the way in which that ties into this particular topic about conversation? And your contributions to this book, are they, for the most part, in a sense, limited to your really specific area of expertise, or do you take that expertise and sort of branch it out into different areas?
Right. Two things. One, body language is not just movement. We have body language going on right now between us because tone of voice, cadence, all of these various aspects of communication are nonverbal communication. So body language encompasses all of that. And another point to make is that human behavior is really my area of expertise. So it's interpersonal skills of all kinds. And I've worked a lot with people in the intelligence community to hone those skills and to find out how to ask questions better, how to answer them better, in addition to a lot of other things about reading body language.
I am really intrigued by the title of the book, Control the Conversation. And I would love to know how you and your co-author, James O'Pyle, came up with that. And one of the reasons I'm prompted to ask that question is because on the one hand, as someone who is in a placed in the position of needing to answer questions, there's something kind of soothing and reassuring about the thought that maybe you can have some measure of control over that conversation. On the other hand, I think sometimes we could imagine that also in a less appetizing fashion in which a conversation needs to take place, and we don't want the other person controlling the conversation or, in
right.
a sense, taking it over. So it's an interesting choice of words. I'm very intrigued to know your thinking behind it.
The thinking behind it is that if you answer a question in a multidimensional way, then you don't surrender control of the conversation. You provide information, you inject information into the answer that takes you in the direction that you want to go. Politicians do this all the time. Some of them do it horribly, and some of them do it very well. I also used to train corporate executives in doing this very thing, and it's just called staying on point. And so you answer the question. Let's say I asked you when you first started on the radio, and instead of just saying, oh, 1986 is when I started here, you would give me a multidimensional answer and say, well, when I started in 1986, I first did this and that. So you would include people, places, time, events, things, all kinds of information in your answer that answers the question, but it also tells me all these other things about you.
So you have taken it into a direction that, in a sense, is of greater advantage to you. It allows you to make sure that you are saying something that you think really needs to be said.
That's exactly right. And so then, logically, if we're having a conversation, my next question to you would be something about what you just said. There would be a hook that you provided me, and I would probably take that hook, and I'd chomp on it.
By the way, I'm a little intrigued to tell you that I started here at WGTD in 1986. So I don't know if that was a wild guess or you've done your homework or some combination of the two. But
Greg, I do my homework.
Clearly.
That's part of the game.
Very good. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Marianne Carinch, and we're talking about her book, Control the Conversation, How to Charm, Deflect, and Defend Your Position. One of the earliest points made in the book that I think is very much worth exploring is to differentiate between the terms respond and answer. And tell us the distinction there that you think matters the most and needs to matter the most for people reading your book and for people engaging in conversations of all types.
Right. Regardless of why somebody is asking you a question, it's best that you know what kind of communication you want to have with that person. What information do you want to give that person so that you can enhance your relationship? If it's a job interview, that's one set of pieces of information that you want to provide. If it's social, it's probably another set of pieces of information. So that's where you start. And answering means you just answer the question. If I said, Do you like what you do? That's a yes or no question. Yes, no. There's really, you know, that's a straight answer. However, if I ask a good narrative question, like what is it about what you do that you enjoy so much? Or what do you enjoy the most? That gives you the opportunity to answer, depending on the situation, to answer with the very specific kind of information, the people, places, things, and time, all those four areas, that will guide the conversation. Hmm. It'll take us in the direction, whether it has to do with your work or your enjoyment of people, you know, like whatever aspect you want to emphasize.
Right. So response is a much richer thing than a simple answer.
It's robust.
Right. I like that distinction very, very much. I want to be sure to mention something that I found absolutely fascinating, and that is an exercise that you invite the reader of your book to do. It involves four questions that are posed to the reader at the very beginning of the book. Explain to our listeners what this exercise is and what it is meant to accomplish or demonstrate.
Sure. Well, we just pose four questions in the introduction that could be answered in a very, very simple way, you know, not a completely unadorned way. And so then at the end of the book, we answer them in a way that is a response as opposed to an answer. And, you know, we could just share that with your listeners now. The four questions that we asked were, where were you on a memorable New Year's Eve? Who was your grandfather on your mother's side? What's your favorite restaurant? And how did you celebrate your birthday last year? So you can give one or two word answers. They're really simple. However, if we want to communicate in a social situation, for example, the kind of response that I would give you would tell you about what's important to me. It would tell you about what sticks in my memory, how I think we might enjoy ourselves together, that kind of thing. So that's the difference.
Hmm. Fascinating. And of course, one of the things you suggest as you spell out this exercise is that by the time people are done reading your book, they are very likely to approach these four questions and respond to them very differently than they did at the outset in sort of the starker, simpler way that you just outlined.
Right, absolutely. I'm sure, but Jim and I are convinced of it, that people lose jobs all the time because they answer questions instead of respond to them. Hmm. So there's a real practical aspect to learning these skills. As we said, we titled the introduction, you can take these skills to the bank. It's absolutely true. Hmm. And someone in your profession is particularly tuned into that. What if you started asking questions and people just gave you one or two word answers? That's frustrating, huh?
it's death.
I know.
Absolutely.
Right.
And it's interesting. Yes, it when we glance at the cover of your book, it appears at a glance to be mostly about answers and responses. But of course, this is also a book that gets us thinking about the quality of the questions that we might find ourselves posing, whether we're someone conducting a job interview or a parent trying to get some information about how their teenage son's day went at school or whatever it might be. Both questions and answers matter. I was really intrigued by something in the first chapter of the book when you talk about grouping people into four different categories in terms of how they tend to answer questions. And it's really interesting to think about where a given person might fall within these four categories, or if perhaps a given person would migrate from category to category according to the occasion. I'd really appreciate it if you would spell out these four categories for our listeners and help us understand how helpful it can be to understand these categories.
Oh, sure. Well, the four categories are handler, dictator, commentator, and evader. A handler contemplates the best way to answer a question. It might be a little drip, drip, drip of information with a sense of, well, okay, now I've formulated where I want to go with this, so I'll just keep dripping information until we move this conversation in a direction that I'd like, so that you're being handled. The dictator just says what is on his or her mind, and I would mention that our president, our current president, it would be that style. That's the style that he has for responding to questions. Commentator, it gives comprehensive answers. I think you'll find that even though, you know, I don't want to be gender specific with this, a lot of times women are commentators. We don't just say this or that, but we, you know, make some connections as well. We give you a little bit more color. It's just kind of how a lot of us think. I wouldn't make that totally gender specific, but that's how women tend to have conversations, or at least my girlfriends and I do.
Right.
An evader tends to sidestep. But that doesn't mean that the person is trying to get rid of you or thinks your question is insignificant. It's just more a way of listening. So let's say I'm a contrarian, which I am, and you ask me a question, and I don't give you the answer that you think I should be giving you. I'm not really on target with the information. It could be that I just heard it differently. That's just how I listen. So with each of these, there's no right or wrong. There's no value judgment associated. It's just how people tend to answer questions.
Hmm. Also in this same chapter, you spell out four areas of disclosure, I think is what you call it. People,
right.
Places, things, and time. And
right.
This might seem at a glance very, very mundane, but you spend enough time on this in the book that it's very clear that in fact this should matter a lot to us, and we need to think about this a bit. Why is it important for us to be aware of this matter of people, places, things, and time in the questions that are posed to us and the answers we give to those questions?
Right. Well, let's look at the fact that those four areas are also areas of discovery if we look at it from a questioning point of view. So think of the interrogatives, the who, what, when, where, how, why, how come, you know, the main interrogatives that would get you talking about something. Those questions point to an area of discovery. So when we respond, let's say, I don't really want to give you an answer to a what question, that it would be my preference to talk about the who. So what we do in the book is we say, you may have been asked a what question in a job interview, but you really want to talk about a who or a why. So we give you the skills to work around that so that you respond, pulling in the four areas of disclosure and then emphasizing the one that you want to go toward.
Through the course of this book, you have us think about the quality of questions and how, first of all, some questions are better than others. I mean, there's such a thing as good questions and bad questions, but also easy questions and tough questions. And
right.
The book is designed to help a person deal better with all of them, to maybe not give short shrift to an easy question, and to not be overly intimidated by a tough question. Help us sort out just kind of how complicated a matter this is in terms of responding well to whatever question is posed to you, be it a bad question, good question, tough question, simple question.
Right. Well, first of all, sometimes people ask questions that create a little bit of pain or anxiety. And so it's important to try to move away from the question. And I want to give an example of a question that was asked that was really kind of thorny, and how the person responded because it shows how you can regain control of a conversation by giving a good response. It was a few years ago, the actress Keira Knightley was doing a promotion for one of her movies, and somebody in the press corps asked her how she managed to balance her life of an actress and mother and wife, and she just was very sweet, and she smiled, and she said, "Are you asking that question of the men that you're speaking with today?" You know? So she answered a question with a question that really took it in a direction that she would prefer, which is to follow it up by talking about the fact that she has a career, just like actors, male actors, have careers. So let's just move in that direction. Let's talk about the movie.
Interesting. I have a feeling that if one is in the business of analyzing conversations and the quality of questions and so on, it probably changes the way you conduct yourself, even in the course of just your ordinary life. Is that true? And in what ways is that true for you, if it's true?
It is true, and I think it's in a good way. I hope it's in a good way. Because, I have a friend who tends to be very other-focused. She loves to learn about people, and she asks questions about other people and their interests, and she takes one hook and goes from one question to another, and she's a lovely, loving person, but it's hard to get to know anything about her. So if you're tuned into listening to that kind of thing, then you can turn it around and say something about you, and that reminds you of something that she did. Tell me more about when you climbed Kilimanjaro. You know, if she's talking about one of my adventures, I'm going to turn it around and talk about one of hers.
I like that. By the way, before we finish, I should give you a chance to touch on some of the really fascinating material that is in the fifth chapter of the book called Answer Enhancers, because this probably does speak to some of the most significant contributions that you specifically made to this book, because they really touch on some of what you have explored as a body language expert. Just explain to our listeners this concept of answer enhancers and how valuable they can be to somebody, particularly in a maybe challenging conversation in which they find themselves.
Sure. One of the things is opening yourself with your body language, indicating invitational body language, so that you look trustworthy, you project that image of openness, receptivity, and that means removing barriers between you and the person, whether it's your arms, a table, your cell phone, a glass of wine, whatever it is. Try to show that you're receptive, you're open, and then that subliminally will enhance the conversation, because there's a sense of trust that you're emanating by being open to that person, physically being open.
And, of course, the chapter goes on to offer up all kinds of other thoughts on that. And then there finally is a section of the book that focuses very specifically on how these skills can be applied in, for instance, job interviews, or in a session where you're trying to sell something, or where you are
right in
a meeting. And even, of course, of great interest to me, a whole chapter devoted to media interviews.
Right.
I suppose someone who has written as many books as you have you've probably been on the receiving end of a lot of frustrating media interviews. What would be your advice to someone who is in the business of interviewing authors, or maybe your advice to somebody who's an author who's going to find themselves in the situation that you're in this morning with me?
Right. Well, first of all, I will say I've been really fortunate. Almost all the time, the conversations that I have with other people, like the conversation I'm having with you, really are rich, and the questioning is good, and it drives us toward real information for the people who are listening to you. So I have not, I don't recall having any really horrible experiences. However, I have listened to a lot of other interviewers out there, and they tend to ask yes or no questions way too much. So sometimes that's what you want, and you know that. You want to corner somebody, but not in a bad way. You just want to know yes or no. That is tough if you are expected to fill air. And, you know, so as an interviewee, if somebody asks you what could be a bad question, if it's just yes or no, you have to escape by adding a lot of information and first responding to the yes or no and then moving on in a direction that you think that person wants to go into.
Well, we'll leave it there, but I hope our listeners who are intrigued by this conversation will seek out your book, which is really packed with all kinds of not only thoughtful ideas about the topic, but also plenty of very practical, applicable tools for being more effective in either end of a conversation in all kinds of different settings and scenarios. The book again is called Control the Conversation: How to Charm, Deflect, and Defend Your Position Through Any Line of Questioning, published by Career Press. The co-author, Marianne Karinch. Marianne Karinch, thank you so much for this conversation. I've enjoyed it very much, and I appreciate the time you've given to The Morning Show today.
You're welcome, Greg. Thank you so much for having me on.
And the time is 8:36. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. In part two of today's program, we go into the archives and to a conversation which I had with best-selling author Mike Rose, with whom I've spoken on more than one occasion. Mike Rose is professor in the UCLA Graduate School of Education and Information Studies. And his previous books include Lives on the Boundary, The Struggles and Achievements of America's Educationally Unprepared, Why School, Reclaiming Education for All of Us, and Back to School, Why Everyone Deserves a Second Chance at Education. We're going to be hearing an excerpt from an interview I recorded with Mike Rose 4.5 years ago about a book called The Mind at Work, Valuing the Intelligence of the American Worker, published by Penguin Books. It was Mike Rose's central contention that many of us who live and work in so-called white-collar America sometimes do not adequately appreciate the intelligence and creativity that is required to do blue-collar work effectively. And Mike Rose spent a lot of time speaking to butchers and hairdressers and all kinds of other people working in those kind of professions and seeking to understand what was most challenging about that kind of work and the kind of skills and intelligence that was required. Here's a portion of our conversation about his book called The Mind at Work.
Sure. I think, you know, any journalist or any researcher who's honest would admit that there's all kinds of anxieties that you have as you go into strange places. Of course, you know, people you don't know and settings that are unfamiliar to you, and you have to work very hard to kind of clear your mind. You know, to as I tell my students all the time, you have to walk in with just all your antenna out. You know, just open up. What do you hear? What do you see? What do you smell? What do you touch? To try and just do your best to be as open to the scene as possible, and to remove from your, you know, from your thinking your preconceptions to the degree you can. And then on the other side of it, as you say, people are wondering, well, who in the heck is this guy, right? So what I would do is that I would make sure that before I visited anybody or went any place, that I was able to talk to them on the phone and have them get to know me a bit and me get to know them, to try and remove some of that awkwardness. And then once I was actually at the place, you know, the place where they work or the school, you know, there would again be that initial sort of uncomfortableness. But I really think I'm not trying to toot my horn here, but I really think the fact that I came from a blue-collar background and that I just know that world so well, I think that helped, you know. I just think it helped. And then when you're in schools, you know, especially with younger students, they're, of course, always going to be a little, you know, reticent and all that. But again, I find that the more you just hang out with them, the more time you spend, the more questions you ask, the more they get to know you, you just become part of the part of the fixtures. Some of the high school or community college classes I was in for a long time. I'd be in for a whole semester. And, you know, after the first few weeks, I was just like another person floating around the room. And people would start, what was so nice, Greg, is that as they got used to me, people would just start talking to me and telling me what they were doing. I wouldn't have to ask a thing. I would just walk up and they'd go, well, this is what I'm doing right now. So that's how I was able to do the project.
I think I especially enjoyed and learned a lot from the chapter on styling hair, because that's particularly something where, although I've obviously had haircuts most of my life, that's really something I've never paid any attention to. And I guess as a customer, I've for a long time come to, on at least some level, appreciate the complexity of what waiters and waitresses do. As someone who eats out all the time, I mean, I know what it's like to receive good service, but honestly, I really tend not to pay any attention whatsoever to the person cutting my hair, and I'm embarrassed to say that because, I mean, just saying those words makes it sound kind of dismissive, and I think on some level I have felt kind of dismissive of the barber or whoever has been cutting my hair. One of the stylists that you talk to like to call it pieces of a puzzle in terms of understanding what exactly to do to please a particular client. What did you come away most deeply appreciating about the men and women who style hair for a living?
Well, I'll tell you, it's so interesting that you bring up that example, because that was the styling hair was the occupation that I knew the least about and that I learned the most about and that surprised me the most, because I you talk about walking in with biases and preconceptions. You know, there's so many stereotypes in popular culture about the hairstylist, right? That, you know, stereotypes that suggest that they're not that bright and it's kind of a frivolous pursuit and, you know, that sort of thing, right? And I got to tell you, I was blown away by the level of knowledge and skill that these folks had and that were involved in doing their job well. So if you think about it, the good stylist has to know some things about the biology of hair, has to know a lot about different products and what kinds of chemical processes result from those products. That person has to have a really good aesthetic sense, has to know a whole lot about different styles and how you execute them. So there's this kind of wonderful, intimate relationship between an aesthetic knowledge and then just the manual skill with, you know, a pair of scissors and a comb and a blow dryer and heating irons and different tools, using those to be able to make that style come to life. So there's all that kind of knowledge. And then there's one more thing, Greg, and this is what really blew me away, and that's the communication skill. And so, you know, if you sit and you sit by a stylist all day and you listen, you hear a lot of chatter, you know, and especially with regulars. Oh, you know, gossip about relationships and what the kids are doing and celebrity news and blah, 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 all this and that. But if you listen closely, woven into all that are all these questions, especially toward the initial part of the cut. These questions that the stylist is asking that is giving her or him a sense of what this person might want. What didn't work so well the last time? what idea do they have in mind about what kind of style they want this time? And sometimes those requests can be pretty vague. I was sitting there, and this woman came in and flopped down into the chair and said to the stylist, "Oh, I don't know, just give me something kind of light and summery." And the stylist, through questions, through playing around with the hair in the mirror, through grabbing a magazine and showing a picture, was able to convert that very vague and almost poetic request into an actual style that this person liked. So I think that takes just an extraordinary degree of listening and problem solving and figuring things out and communicating to make that happen. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting you bring up styling hair, because that was the occupation that taught me the most and that most surprised me in terms of just the degree of cognitive content involved.
Right. Another point you make in that chapter, related in a sense to this whole matter of communication, is that at one point you say something about how when it comes to haircuts and hairstyles and so on, there is this lingo, this language that we tend to assume we're all using the same, when in fact often we're not.
Yeah.
That one person says such and such a word and means something, and someone else will use that term and they'll really mean something rather significantly different. And for the hairstylist, sometimes that's among the greatest challenges, is sorting out what somebody really means when they use a particular term.
That was so interesting to me. And if you think about it, that skill runs across a whole series of professions, including healthcare. One stylist said to me, "Never assume that when somebody says red, they mean red." And another stylist said, people will say to you, "Take off an inch," and then they'll hold their fingers up and their fingers are really showing 2 or 3 inches. And so that's where that communication becomes so important. And the skilled stylist knows when somebody says something like that to ask those further questions that really do get to exactly what that person means.
Hmm. And, of course, you explore the worlds of carpentry and plumbing as well, which I think those are vocations where I think a lot of us have, in a sense, a different a level of appreciation. But that's not to say, I mean, I think most of us realize that you have to be really smart to be a good plumber. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, we have absolutely no sense of actually the complexities that the typical plumber is dealing with all the time, the imagination and the creativity that is often involved in, for instance, diagnosing a problem or sorting out what the most effective solution to a problem can be. And as you point out quite rightly, the stakes are really high when it comes to what the typical plumber does.
Right. Now, you know, of course, look, a lot of the plumber's work, especially in just regular residential kind of work, a lot of the work is pretty routine, you know, the leaky faucet, the plugged up toilet, that kind of thing. And so that's routine. But when you follow these guys around, men or women around, what you see is that sometimes even the routine job can turn out to be much more complex than it seemed. So, you know, it seems like it's a straightforward thing, and, oh, I'm going to, you know, clear this toilet or whatever, but oops, something else is going on here. So that's one thing that struck me, that even though a lot of the work is routine, there's always this place of surprise. And the good plumber is kind of astute for that. The second thing I want to say, this was such an interesting thing. I was talking to a guy. He was simply putting in a new garbage disposal, but it was running into some problems just because of the way things were configured under the sink, and so he had to do some adjusting to make it work right. And he said the most interesting thing when I was asking him about what he was doing, he said, "You know, something that you learn is that you always have to," how did he put it? He said, "You have to know when to say no as well as when to say yes." And he's talking about himself with his own thinking processes. That is, he's got to be good at being able to say, "Whoops, no, wait a minute, don't do that. That could possibly lead to X or Y problem. And so I thought that was a really interesting way to think as well, that he's kind of weighing these options and weighing possible solutions to problems, but having to come up with the right one, or as you just said, the consequences can be pretty dramatic. Now, where you really see the skill come through, is when these folks are working on old houses that have like a series of repairs, and some of them are kind of makeshift. Often the fixtures that are used are outdated and no longer available. And that's where you start to see the creativity and the ability to solve problems. In the book, I talk about a plumber who, in an old house, has a small opening in a wall. And since he can't take out the whole wall, he reaches up behind that opening, and he is feeling the pipes behind the wall and visualizing through his feeling them, visualizing what they look like, the kind of shape they're in. Through his touch, he can get a sense of the level of corrosion, and he's helping himself solve a problem through this kind of complicated thing that he's doing with his hand, which is resulting in visualization, which is resulting in problem solving. So it's that kind of stuff, you know, when you see it time and again, you just think, oh my gosh, these folks are some of their work's routine, but some of it really calls on their ability to draw on knowledge and solve complicated problems.
Right. It's this cognitive level of the work they're doing that we don't appreciate, those of us who aren't directly engaged in that. And we should mention that your book not only helps us understand how cognitive so much of the work of plumbers and waitresses and welders is, but you also help us sort of take it the other direction as well, that, for instance, by looking closely at the work that a surgeon does, mm-hmm. we come to realize that is not a fully intellectual vocation at all, but also is very much manually oriented, that one is working with one's hands. It is very tactile, and it bears remarkable similarity to, for instance, the work that a plumber or a carpenter might be doing. And we just tend not to think in those terms.
You know, what I wanted to do to just give myself more information and also to check and make sure that I was on the right track is I wanted to look at some high-status jobs that also involve this kind of intimate relation of hand and brain, right? So I looked at physical therapists and I looked at general surgeons, and I spent a lot of time with both of those occupations. And, you know, at the heart of one of the ideas at the heart of the mind at work, Greg, is to try and dispel this easy distinction that we always make between hand and brain. Oh, that's hand work. Oh, that's brain work, right? And what I wanted to do was to look at all these occasions where that distinction just falls apart. And it was obvious with carpentry and plumbing and hairstyling, and it was just as obvious with surgery or physical therapy. So what you saw again and again with these surgeons was all the book learning they had to have, all the knowledge of anatomy and physiology, huge amounts. I mean, you know what medical school is like, and then the kind of training even before that. But that is all effective only to the degree that they can translate it into all of this manual skill and all of the kinds of intellectual things they have to do through feel and sight and through the use of the senses. So that a surgeon will talk about, for example, the general structure of the anatomy in your abdomen. But it's only when that surgeon is actually in and doing the work and feeling and touching and seeing the particular ways that your anatomy is structured and what previous surgeries might have done or other kinds of injuries or pathology. It's through all of the feel and the touch and the intimate blending of the hand with all of that book knowledge, that's what makes a surgeon successful. Mm. And so this kind of breaking down of hand and brain stuff was true whether we're talking about carpentry or surgery.
Before we finish, I want you to say just a word about the whole educational system and the way in which it has tended to foster this divide between intellectual work and manual labor, and the way in which revisions in vocational education maybe have taken a step or two in the right direction, while by no means eliminating some of these biases.
Right. So, you know, I think that the problem really started in education with the creation of the large comprehensive high school in the 19-teens and 20s. And you know, it was done for a complex set of reasons. There was a sudden influx of a lot more students who were coming into the country and who were people who were wanted to go to high school. And so the creation of the big comprehensive high school, that is one that you and I, I'm sure, remember, where you had these tracks, right? There was the vocational track and a kind of general track and then a college prep track. Well, that separation in the curriculum of the academic and the vocational course of study that's over 100 years old, I think, has really helped reinforce this split between, you know, hand work and brain work. And we've been spending a fair amount of the last 20 or 30 years trying to do our best to figure out how to negotiate that split and how to heal it. And I think in the best vocational programs, and I'm sure some of this kind of stuff goes on at the college where you're at Gateway, people are trying to figure out how to get back to this kind of intimate connection between brain work and hand work, that these, you know, aren't vastly separate ways that people use their minds, and that they're really pretty intimately connected. So I'm hopeful. I mean, it's a very hard thing to do because this is a 100-year-old tradition we're talking about, but I'm hopeful that at least in some of the really good occupational vocational programs, they're working hard to try and reclaim the mind in the mind at work.
Mm. I appreciate how you say that one of the main purposes of your book is to help us think more clearly and fairly about some of these issues, and in particular, more clearly and more fairly think about the potential that various people have. And of course, that means not shutting doors or pushing people along certain paths, but opening up all kinds of doors to exciting possibilities. And at the same time, your book also helps us really appreciate so much of the work that goes on all the time that we don't really stop to think about. And of course, we all got our hair cut, we all get served by a waiter or waitress, but there's a whole world out there of people who are toiling to build our roads and dig out tunnels and go down into mines, and that's the kind of work that tends to be invisible to many of us and utterly unappreciated. And just by helping us to think about this whole sector of the working population, you're also reminding us of that.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I mean, that's what I set out to do. I wanted to try and change the way we see things. So what happens when you sit at the counter and watch that waitress? What do you start to see? One of the most gratifying things that has happened over the time that this book has been out is I'll get an email or a letter or something from someone saying, geez, I was sitting at a lunch counter in such and such a city, and I was reading your book at the same time that I was watching the waitress, and I was beginning to see things in a different way, or I was beginning to see what she was doing or understand what she was doing. And that's gratifying, because that's really what I set out to do, Greg, is to just try and help us see some of the things that have become invisible to us.
The book, again, is The Mind at Work, Valuing the Intelligence of the American Worker, a paperback from Penguin Books, now in this special 10th anniversary edition. Mike Rose, thank you so much for writing this book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
And it's a minute before 9 o'clock here on WGTD. And tomorrow on The Morning Show, I'm excited to share with you an interview that I am about to record with Bryant Welch, who is a nationally known clinical psychologist and an attorney who back in 2008 wrote a book published by St. Martin's Press called State of Confusion, Political Manipulation and the Assault on the American Mind. He has just revised his book, bringing it up to date with some of what we have experienced as a nation in the last few years. And we will be listening to that conversation on tomorrow's morning show. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock.